Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. Here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Emma Stein. She's assistant curator of South and Southeast Asian art at the Smithsonian National Museum of Asian Art. We'll be talking about a fascinating, important contribution to the field called Constructing Kanchi, a City of Infinite Temples. Emma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Raj. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here today with you.
Thank you. This will be a fun conversation indeed. Tell me, what is it that you do? You know, your work as a curator. Before we dive into the book, give a bit of a background of what that's like, what that involves.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. So I work at the National Museum of Asian Art. My area is, our collection really covers South Asia, Southeast Asia, and the Himalayas. But my primary responsibility is our Southeast Asia collection and also South India because of the research that I've done directly for this book and in my doctoral work, studying Chola bronzes, processions, Hindu ritual, religious culture, et cetera. So my job at the museum is often taking extremely complex material and making it legible, accessible, exciting, transformative for general public audiences and for everybody who ranges from specialist experts to, to young children. So it's a big challenge, but I really enjoy the public facing aspect of
it. It sounds like you do a visual version of this podcast.
I think that's right.
Fantastic. Tell us a bit about that journey. I mean, did you always want to go into curation? What got you on this path? Was it related to your PhD? Were they separate? Like, how did that work out for you?
I've always been an objects person and a space person. I actually have a background as a professional dancer. I was a modern dancer trained in Martha Graham technique in New York. And Martha Graham technique is extremely three-dimensional. It's all about spirals around your back and turning around your spine and kind of impulses from your torso moving out into your extremities. So I've always thought about the body in space. And I think that really informs my understanding of art and architecture and my love of temples and spaces to explore that have all these different sizes and shapes of areas that contain the body or contain the gods inside. So that background as a dancer certainly drove me to be interested in museums and in objects. And my goal as an art historian and in pursuing a PhD was always to become a curator. I love to teach, I love to lecture and things like that, but certainly the idea of juxtaposing objects and creating spaces in galleries was the direction that I wanted to go.
Dancer and a doctor, a multifaceted individual indeed. Just to drill down on this a little bit more, I think there might be some interest among public. Are curators typically PhDs, or are you the exception, would you say?
Curators now typically are PhDs, yes. In previous generations, sometimes going into a museum with a collection was really the only opportunity to study that type of work. And curators have been responsible for creating sort of new academic disciplines within art history. So some of the more senior curators and from previous generations didn't have PhDs, mostly because there was no where to study what they did and no one to study with. But certainly today, curators generally have PhDs.
So then this book is the result of your doctoral research, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so now tell us how you was it the desire to curate that got you into the PhD program, or, what's the backstory behind the book? How did you get interested in this particular topic?
Great question. Trying to think how far back to go. The way that I fell in love with India was really through Cambodian temples and dance. My first trip to Asia was to Cambodia in 2004. And I was captivated by the sheer number of temples. Of course, we've all heard of Angkor Wat, but as soon as you start to do the tiniest amount of research, you realize that Angkor Wat is one temple among a complex of dozens of temples in the immediate area. That plus the beauty of the carvings and the lushness of the landscape really captured my imagination. It took me a long time to get back to doing a PhD, but because I was dancing at that point. But I think that interest in a place that had many, many temples built up over the course of many centuries never left me. I think that lingered. And so when I decided that it was time to pursue my doctoral studies, that was always a goal. I did my BA in art history at Columbia. I danced parallel to that. And then I danced for about 7 years and then entered the art world fully. When I decided it was time to pursue the PhD and I began to look for a topic, it was clear that I really needed to work in South Asia rather than Southeast Asia. In part, that was due to opportunity in the USA. At that point, there really wasn't anyone specializing in Southeast Asian temple architecture in a university PhD program that I could go to study with. And I think now there's starting to be much more of an incorporation of Southeast Asia into the academic discipline. But I also understood that I really needed to learn the roots of the religious traditions that informed and architectural planning that informed Southeast Asian temples. So I searched for a topic and a place where I could study India, but with this kind of wider lens, like looking towards trans-regional connections, looking for a site that would feed this interest in a wider integrated region across South and Southeast Asia. And I took a field trip to India the first summer of my PhD program and just sort of went looking for a site to work on. I went to India and Sri Lanka and I spent one day in Kanchi. That was it. But that was the place that lingered. And I think it kind of reignited also that excitement that I'd first felt in Cambodia about a place with many temples, a lot of activity. Of course, in Kanchi, it's mostly living temples that are vibrant with ritual and pilgrims and visitors coming in every day. So that aspect of the living city, of a place with many temples, a place that had not been written about comprehensively before. And then as I started to do research, I found that there were all these connections to other parts of India and to Southeast Asia, and that Kanchi had this legendary history that went far beyond the era of the Pallavas and the Cholas alone.
So the holy city of Kanchi, Kanchipuram, this is a major, to contextualize, I imagine a great many of the audience members would know this, but Kanchi is an ancient, venerable, sacred site, comparable, for example, to perhaps Varanasi. You know, it's a site of massive pilgrimage and temples galore. And if you didn't know that, then the subtitle is a spoiler alert, City of Infinite Temples. So you touch down in Kanchi, and that day, you know, awoke in your lifetimes of asanas of exposure to all things Kanchi, and you were hooked. Okay, I get it. Sometimes people ask why I chose a Devi Mahatmya or even Puranas. I'm like, I'm not sure I had much say in the matter, frankly.
Yeah, maybe you could say Kanchi chose me, but I don't know. Maybe that's you.
the book is fascinating on a number of levels. Let's just start super basic. What's the book about? Like, what is your main quandary, question, you know, like, what is the book trying to show or do?
So the book's really about the growth and development and transformation of Kanchi during primarily the era of the Pallavas and the Cholas, which was the time that it was a royal capital for these two important South Indian dynasties. And it was also the period of the beginning of sacred architecture in the durable medium of stone in South India. Other parts of India have longer histories of stone temple architecture, but in the South, it really begins in earnest kind of late 7th century and then really picks up in the 8th century. So the Pallavas and the Cholas reign from about the 8th through 13th century during this heightened period of temple construction. And I was curious about the way that temples function in the urban landscape, how they contributed to the shifting borders of the city. Is the current footprint of the city the same as it always has been for all intents and purposes, or has it moved over time? How's it structured? How's it layered? And then how has it been changed in the aftermath, in the many centuries since that period of initial accelerated construction?
Yeah, so there's so many different there's so many different points of entry. Let me just pick one. Is it common, like, do we have a scholarship on cities? Like, do we have monographs on various Indic cities, or is that fairly rare?
There's certainly been a lot of work done on Varanasi, which you mentioned earlier. And I think that it's, and on Halabidu, Catherine Kasdorf did her PhD work there. And actually our work intersects in a number of ways in the ways we've looked at the structure of cities. So I'm sure I'm leaving out a lot of important work, but in terms of
sure.
Just on a city,
To my mind, it seems relatively scant. I mean, you'd have a different perspective because you've obviously, this is your area of expertise, but it seems to me from the broader Hindu studies context that there are relatively few monographs that will have a city as the subject of the monograph. So that's one of the interesting aspects of this work. You mentioned the dynasties, the kingdoms, and the historical period that you're focusing on. Would you say this is an historical work? Is that your primary or exclusive methodology?
I think that the purpose of studying history is to understand the present. And I'm always interested in the way that history informs the present. So while the first two chapters definitely focus in that 8th through 13th century or 7th through 14th century moment, the rest of the book just kind of spirals out from there. And all the way through, there's a grounding and a context in the contemporary and in the texture of the city today. So it is historical, but I would hope that this book would also be of interest to anyone working on the colonial period, on post-colonialism, and then on present day Hindu culture, religion, art history, temple architecture, and urbanism.
Well, you preempted one of my questions, which was, you know, who might be interested in this book or what subfields might it engage? Why don't you give us a lay of the land of how the book is structured?
So the book is structured through the pairing of kshetra and kshatra, this dual principle of dominion that is known from South Asian literature about kingship and sovereignty. And so kshetra is a Sanskrit term meaning field. And so it can be the terrestrial field, like it can be a field a farmer plows. It can also be the field meaning the body as the field for the indwelling soul. It's a really beautiful concept. So kshetra is, sorry, go ahead.
No, I couldn't resist the famous opening lines of the Bhagavad Gita come to mind, right? Mm-hmm. Dharma kshetra, kurukshetra. So it is a beautiful metaphor. I just, one of my last podcast interviews was with Karen O'Brien, Cop, who was talking about the use of agricultural metaphors like seed, the toasting of the seeds, and it's Buddhist, it's Hindu, it's this metaphor that's so pervasive, and what kinds of seeds are they referring to? So it's definitely a rich metaphor. It's not typically my habit to interrupt folks on this podcast, so I apologize. Please continue.
Oh, please, that was a great interruption. Thank you. So kshetra is the terrestrial dominion of a sovereign. And so the first half of the book is kind of this kshetra of Kanchi, which is where are the temples located? Where are the roads located? Where are the rivers located? Where are the fields located? You know, what order were things built? Kind of making chronologies, both relative chronologies between buildings and roads, and also even within individual structures and within individual shrines within those structures. And then we, you know, so once we've laid the field, we've defined our boundaries, we've defined our ground, then the book transitions into this less tangible aspect of dominion, which is kshatra, which is sphere of influence. So what was Kanchi's sphere of influence beyond the boundaries of the city? So what happened in the villages, in the agrarian hinterlands that surround the city? How were those transformed during the time that the city was kind of coming up? And then what was the city's role in larger transregional networks of Buddhism, of circulation of goods and ideas, primarily religious cultures, traditions across a wider region? And then how did Kanchi compare with other cities across this wider region where it had reach, it had connections? How did it compare structurally? I looked far and wide for other cities that had a similar kind of structuring of this dense but wide distribution of temples, where the city kind of squeezes in between the temples and there's a close coordination between temples and roads, which I hope we'll talk more about. And I didn't find other places in India that were comparable, certainly not in Tamil Nadu. Sometimes people bring up Kumbakonam because it's another city in Tamil Nadu that has multiple temples, but it's not exactly structured the same way that Kanchi is. So I looked for these comparisons and I found them more across Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka. And if we think back to that first excitement that I felt in Cambodia and looking at Angkor and the way that there was this multiplicity of temples in an urban area. And now with all the archaeological work that's being done in Cambodia, we know that people were living chock-a-block within the temples, within the temple complexes and around them, and that the city of Angkor was structured in a way much like Kanchi, where the city is everywhere and the temples are everywhere too, right? So the third chapter moves into this more, I would even say more speculative kind of a wider scope of inquiry that I hope that future researchers will take up and do even more granular comparisons between these cities. I hope that urban studies scholars will work this way, and that experts within each of those areas will also try to peel away the layers from their cities in a similar manner with Kanchipuram in mind. And then we move sort of chronologically as well forwards, radically in time, to the colonial period and to travelers' accounts, early photographic surveys, records of the Archaeological Survey of India from its formative period in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and look at what happened in Kanchi during that time and how that can reveal changes to the structures that have happened in relatively recent, very recent history, even since the 20th century, to how we see the city today.
You mentioned in passing this tantalizing thought about the association between temples and roads, and now you'll have to fill us in on that association.
Absolutely. So this is for me the most fascinating aspect of Kanchi, is that it's structured with this hidden footprint, this hidden urban plan, and a beautiful symmetry, where temples face each other from across a central thoroughfare. So there's a main road that runs right through the center of the city. And it's still a main road. Historically, it was a main road beginning around the year 1000, but still today, it's the widest street in town. It cuts right through. It's busy with traffic from about 6 o'clock in the morning until well after sundown, which makes taking a photograph of it really difficult. But what I found as I began to map Kanchi's temples, because my process was really just walking around the city. It's a city, but it's a small city. You can walk. It's a long walk from one side to the other. But I would walk because that way I would sort of trip over things, and I would find temples that hadn't been previously documented before, some of which were active shrines and others were more or less hidden behind perpetually locked gates. And I could just see the tower of its central sanctum kind of peeking out over the enclosure walls. So as I started to document the temples in the city and to map them, the two things that I would always make sure to note were deity of dedication. Was it Shiva? Was it Vishnu? Was it the goddess? Was it Murugan? Was it someone else? And orientation, which way did the temple face? And what I found was I started at a point in time, I started to be able to predict which direction the temple would face as I was approaching the temple. And as I placed more and more of them on a map and noted the orientation, I started to see that they were all facing towards the middle of the city. So they were facing something, east or west. You know, it wasn't on a kind of diagonal. It was east or west, no matter where they were placed in the city. And there are some exceptions. So I began to wonder, what is it that they're facing? They're facing each other, but maybe there's something at the center of town. And then I started mapping roads as well. And what I found was that it wasn't a singular structure, though I do think there was a royal palace somewhere in the middle, but sort of towards the north of the city, towards the northern part of the city. But they were all facing this road. So no matter where in Kanchi a temple was located, if it was to the east of the road, if it was on the east side of town, it was facing west. And if it was to the west of the road, if it was on the west side of town, it was facing east. So the gods were kind of seeing eye to eye, which is something that's said locally by some of the priests, especially. They say in Kanchi, the gods see to eye to eye. But they were also facing this main road into and out of the city. It's fascinating, and the pattern dissolves as soon as you get outside of the city, either north or south, but the road continues. And I began to follow this road, both north and south, and found that to the south, it leads to a whole string of places that today are pretty humble villages, but they have these massive stone temples from the Chola period primarily that were carved by the same expert stone carvers who were working on the temples in Kanchi and in the region. And those temples speak to a former level of prosperity and prosperousness that these places once had. So that's the southern end. And on the northern end, it follows also, or it arrives at several other sites that have these monumental temples that speak to the legacy of the place. And it eventually arrives at Tirupati, which is an extremely famous place in South India, in India more broadly. It's probably the most important Vaishnava destination today. It's a hilltop temple known as the Golden Temple. And people still regularly traverse this journey between Kanchi and Tirupati. It's an ancient processional route that's still followed today. So the road itself was this main point of access. It was a sacred road. It was a commercial road. It linked the city with areas to the north and the south. And within the city, it functioned as this spinal cord that all temples oriented towards.
This pattern, this layout that you've discovered, do we have a sense of the agency behind it and or the historical period? How far back does this pattern go?
Mm-hmm. It goes back remarkably far. What I found is that all of the temples that were built during the Pallava period, so primarily between the 7th and 9th centuries, with this period of heightened activity during the 8th century, those are all situated farther to the west. So they're all kind of on the western half of Kanchi today. And the Kailasanatha temple is the most most famous of all of them. And Padma Kaimal has recently written a monograph just about that temple and about its history. Most of the research that's been done in Kanchi and even, you know, since the colonial period has been on the Kailasanatha temple in particular, and sometimes with attention to other Pallava temples in the city. The Kailasanatha today stands on all the way on the western side of town. It's in a pretty quiet area. There's one street that leads to it. There is a small temple built about 3 centuries later that stands just near it that today is a popular sort of popular local devotional site. It was restored and revitalized during my field work, which was wonderful to see. But the Kailasanatha is an archaeologically protected monument. It's not a major pilgrimage destination anymore. It's more frequented by the rare foreign traveler who comes to Kanchi. But that was the main royal temple in the Pallava period. It probably wasn't on the western outskirts of town at that point. But what started to happen towards the end of the 8th century is that temples start getting built farther to the east. So I feel there was this impetus to kind of start to shift the city in that direction, or expand the city in that direction, really. So the borders start to move on the eastern side. And several other large temples like the Vaikuntha Perumal and the Mukteshvara and Matangeshvara, which are other Pallava period temples, were built farther on that side of town. And interestingly, those temples, while Kailasanatha faces east, which, you know, you could argue is the most standard direction for temples to face, it's certainly the most common. Those three temples built slightly later, they all face west. So there's something starting right then in the second half of the 8th century. And I don't know what prompts it. I don't know why, but it starts around then, and then it just continues. And by around the year 1000, so many more temples had been built. At this point, Kanchi is under the dominion of the Cholas, and so many more temples were built in that more western area of the city. And they follow this pattern of orientation. If they're east of the main road, which by that point took over, there was an earlier road that led into and out of the Pallava area of the city, towards the Kailasanatha temple from the south. But by around the year 1000, that new main road had taken over, and more temples get built with their orientations towards it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is fascinating for so many reasons. One can easily envision a central deity temple figure that is sort of the hub of the orienting. And yet in this case, it's not something stationary. It's a path, right? It's a means of moving to and fro. And one wonders if there wasn't at some point some massive murti that was, processed along that path. Like, mm-hmm. he or she was taken out of their massive, you know, this is a word I've invented in English, uber shaktified, you know, sanctum. And when the deity would come up that road, all the deities of the local temples were already facing it. Mm-hmm. Comes to mind as well. I've spent a fair bit of time in a South Indian temple north of Toronto, the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple. Fascinating. I've learned a great deal actually being at that temple. One wonders, certainly there are various shastras, agamas, wherein we find the do's and don'ts of temple maintenance, the rituals required, you know, the Vastuvian direction on like should the murtis face north, south, east, which murtis can be in which locations. If it's, you know, one wonders if there isn't a body of shastra somewhere that talks about, I realize this is well beyond the purview of your already very substantive contribution, but one wonders if there aren't rules known locally in terms of what was going on with this. It looks like some branch of Vastu even was going on, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. And I do wonder if it was written, but I also wonder which came first, the scripture or this kind of convention of building. Because it's so local, because I can't find anywhere comparable, it seems that if it were scripture, if it were written, we might find that text had circulated, right? Because it's easier for a text to circulate than it is for, I don't know, an architectural plan of a city, which didn't exist, to circulate. And the way that this convention, which I do believe was a local convention preserved through local knowledge, the way that this has persisted even until the present, even today when temples are built, they're built such that they face the road. Not always, there are exceptions, but the fact that we still find this today, but nobody talks about it, makes me think that it is more just a matter of what you do.
Local custom.
Yeah, yeah. It has always been done this way, so we do it this way, as opposed to it being, you know, it is written, so we do it this way.
But and then also,
if someone
who knows,
I would be delighted.
Who knows? It also begs the question whether or not these teachings are in oral memory somewhere pundit lineages locally. Who knows? It's fascinating. Clearly there's method to this madness, great method that we're only starting to note thanks to your research. Just a textual analog, I don't know, somehow stumbled upon the fact that the Devi Mahatmya is constructed in a sophisticated ring composition, mm-hmm. where we find sometimes we find order where we least expect it. Mm-hmm. There's method to the madness behind the construction of Kanchi, for sure.
And I do wonder if this saying, you know, in Kanchi the temples see eye to eye, which is mostly spoken by older priests, if that is a kind of vestige of this knowledge.
It would be conjecture for sure, but it, to my mind, yeah, definitely. Absent any evidence, it can't be by chance that practice is local custom, and so is that saying, and that practice maps onto the saying. You know, whether or not people consciously realize or remember where that saying comes from, definitely seeing eye to eye seems to map onto the layout of the city, which is fascinating. I'd like to ask you a question that is, you know, a little more broad and maybe beyond your particular field of expertise, but you may well have more insight into this than I do. What do we know about when temple Hinduism begins? Do we have a sense?
By the Chola period, there's an expansion of the types of sectors of society who seem to have been participants in temple life. We find this in inscriptions, That there were donations made by a wider range of individuals. And there are also spaces that are kind of literally built in the temple that seem to accommodate a larger number of devotees. There are mandapas, which are these kind of pavilions that are shelters for pilgrims. There are feeding halls that are specified in inscriptions as being for pilgrims traveling, for example, between Kanchi and Tirupati along that ancient pathway. There's an enhancement to the kinds of facilities that temples are connected with. There's a temple and in what's today a village called Tirumukudal at the confluence of the Palar and Cheyar rivers, south of Kanchi, but along the main road, that has a lengthy inscription from the 11th century about all of the different kinds of establishments that participated in this temple and that the temple was directly responsible for, including a hospital, feeding house, and educational facility, places for watering animals. You know, it really seemed to accommodate a great number of visitors. So it's within that Chola era, which is, you know, precisely the time that my book is looking at, when so many more temples are built in Kanchi, and each of those temples has such a larger footprint than any of the Pallava era temples did. This is not to say that I believe that the Pallava temples were exclusively for members of the royal court, but I think we have the evidence there a couple centuries later for this swelling of personnel and of clientele for the temples. It's also the time when we know that religious processions of Hindu bronze icons of deities was in full swing. We have, again, inscriptions talking about donations of bronzes to temples, talking about processions, talking about rituals that took place. Those are in lesser numbers, in fewer numbers than donative records of gifts of perpetual lamps for the gods or sheep to facilitate the oil for the lamps or land for cultivating a temple flower garden or funds for repairing a tank. The ongoing maintenance and repairs and renovations that have happened with, have had to take place for stone temples is just a continuing fact of life even today.
What do you most hope folks might take away from this book?
I hope that they'll see that Kanchi was never in a period of decline, that there was never a pause to its momentum, to its vibrancy, to its importance. And there's a whole line of narrative in colonial literature that uses words like dilapidation, decay, decline, deterioration, abandon, ruin. And I hope that through this work, anyone who reads this will see that that was a fiction. Kanchi was a bustling, crowded city, replete with festivals and precious resources, both natural and material throughout the colonial period. It didn't have a pause, and it continues that way today.
An important intervention indeed. Tell us, what was behind this perspective among earlier colonial scholars about the dilapidation, the decline? You know, what was driving that characterization of Kanchi?
Well, it was a characterization of South Asia more broadly, and it fostered the belief in their own necessity in the region, in the empire, and in earlier colonial speculation in the area. There was a tendency, I've found, you know, now I can speak more specifically to Kanchi, because it had such a wide range of temples, some of which, you know, today have become archaeologically preserved, and others have become still these large, you know, popular centers of devotion, of active devotion. Already by the 18th, 19th century, the Pallava temples, which then were selected for archaeological preservation, it all connects, those were in a relative state of disuse, okay? And some of this is because there's a tendency within Tamil Nadu, at least, for temples that were established by royal dynasties to fall out of use when the dynasty is no longer in power. And temples that were built or rebuilt or reconstructed as a result of local patronage tend to continue. They continue that legacy generation to generation of devotees. And this is, this trend has been pointed out by a team of scholars from the École Française d'Extrême-Orient who have been very useful and helpful colleagues for my work. Valerie Gillet, Charlotte Schmidt, and Emmanuel Francis. They've looked at this difference between what they call royal and local bhakti, and the differences between royal temples and local temples. So the Pallava temples were royal temples in Kanchi. They were built by members of the royal court or kings, and they did not sustain the same level of devotion after the Pallava period. So by the time colonial visitors came, or foreign visitors came in the colonial period, they found these Pallava temples in sort of quiet areas of the city. Remember, by this point, the city has radically shifted away from the Kailasanatha temple, which is this large temple that was being used by just a small number of very local devotees, you know, just in the immediate vicinity, living right around the temple grounds. And the other temples were kind of overgrown. They were half buried. They were actually dilapidated. But what happened is that the early surveys tended then to focus on those temples to the exclusion of all of the active temples in the city. And some of that may have been a result surely of convenience, that they could photograph there uninterrupted. They could get, you know, they could just walk around freely and observe. Whereas there seems to have already been some level of restricted entry at places like Ekambaranatha and Kamakshi Aman, which were, you know, which were still very active at the time. And so this focus on the Pallava temples also served the story of India being in a state of decline, and therefore the colonial officials who were coming to, you know, relative positions of power, even within Kanchi, really had to be there, of course, right? Because Kanchi really needed help.
Of course, of course.
Serve that story, right?
Of course, and the Puranas are debased texts that are the result of priestcraft and folly, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. Certainly, such biases are not unknown in my own research. So is this work that you're continuing? Is, you know, what's next?
Well, my focus really is the museum, but my work is largely, my research is largely fieldwork based, and I will always continue this larger project of mapping sacred sites and their connections with landscape across a wider South and Southeast Asian region. I have plenty of field trips that I'd like to do to add sites to a growing resource called Sacred Sites in Southeast Asia, which is an interactive map that I've built with colleagues at the museum and at the Smithsonian. It's it's accessed through the Southeast Asia Area Collection, part of the National Museum of Asian Art website. And you can explore temple sites throughout. We've put up Cambodia, Indonesia, and Myanmar, and see photographs and read sort of short photo essays about many of those places. So that's a resource that I hope to continue to build and plan to continue to build. I actually have two exhibitions that opened very recently at the National Museum of Asian Art. One is an exhibition from our collection of prehistoric ceramics from northeastern Thailand. It's called Prehistoric Spirals, Earthenwares from Thailand, which I collaborated with two of our conservators and conservation scientists at the National Museum of Asian Art. And then just on April 30th, we opened a big exhibition. It's an adaptation from the Cleveland Museum of Art. It's called Revealing Krishna, Journey to Cambodia's Sacred Mountain. And it really is a synthesis of this interest that I've had for so long in the connection between art and landscape, because it's about a monumental sculpture of the Hindu god Krishna lifting the sacred mountain Govardhan that was found in a cave temple in southern Cambodia, about halfway up a sacred mountain called Phnom Da. It's very rare with Cambodian sculpture that we know the actual site that a sculpture came from. And we know so much, thanks to recent archaeological research, about the connection between that sculpture and the cultural and physical landscape that surrounded it. Continuing on with projects that seem to come back to Kanchi, everything seems to come back to Kanchi. Several of us have been researching a group of yoginis from Tamil Nadu. There's been quite a number of studies. Padma Kaimal wrote an entire book about them, and we're continuing. I'm working with the Detroit Institute of Arts to plan an exhibition and just continuing the research on them. It turns out that another yogini from that group is actually located in a local temple in Kanchi. I had seen it during the course of my field work and went back right before the pandemic to confirm its identity. So there are several of us who are continuing to work on this, and I expect that it will lead us again and again to the city of Kanchi.
Listen, you've got all these past lives of karma to work out in Kanchi. So here we are. All roads lead to Kanchi. Well, clearly you have no shortage of endeavors which sound significant and which clearly feed you, which clearly you're excited about. So that's great. It's fascinating. You'll have to come back on the podcast sometime, whether pertaining to publication or perhaps more broad conversation about an exhibit or such.
Thank you. That would be such a pleasure. It's really wonderful speaking with you. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Likewise. So for those of you listening, we've been talking to Dr. Emma Stein, who's assistant curator of South and Southeast Asian art at the Smithsonian National Museum of Asian Art. We've been speaking about a brand new Amsterdam University Press publication called Constructing Kanchi, City of Infinite Temples. Until next time, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the ancient city of Kanchi. Take care.